It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with a splendid table. Imagine this. Two wild truffles reaching out to each other across an abyss, desperately trying to escape from their same-sex prisons. Well, this is a scientific discovery. Wild truffles cost so much because you can't cultivate them. Well, now scientists know why. Where other fungi reproduce without sex, truffles are male and female, and they grow in same-sex clusters far apart. So if we can get an eHarmony-style matching system going for truffles, these $1,000-a-pound black lumps could be as cheap as a button mushroom. Stay with us for other revelations this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we have a running theme this week. Inspiration, as in letting it in and taking a flyer on something you've not tried before. For instance, on those nights when you hang on the refrigerator door, scanning the shelves for ideas, and the only inspiration that comes is order pizza, well, in those moments, you need the spirit of a cook who is constantly riffing, who's a master at turning the mundane into the magnificent. Well, Diana Henry, British food writer par excellence, has this drill down pat. Her latest book is Salt, Sugar, Smoke, and she joins us from London. Diana, welcome back.
Lovely to be with you again, Lynn.
Hey, you know what I want to talk about? I want to talk about where you go for inspiration because, you know, you guys on the other side of the pond, your heads go in very different directions when it comes to coming up with ideas.
I think, well, we have a very kind of magpie culture in terms of cookery in this country. You know, we have lots of Indian restaurants, and now in London we're getting more Eastern European restaurants. We have a lot of Middle Eastern influence in London as well. That was one of the great, I mean, I'm from Ireland, so I didn't grow up with this at all. But when I moved to London, I felt like, you know, I could have landed in the Lebanon, and I used to make forays every Saturday to the bits of London where, you know, you could get those kind of ingredients. So I will certainly think about the Middle East, and also partly because that food, it's so inexpensive, but it's so exotic. So what they can do with a lentil, you know, it's not the way we used to think about lentils at all. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have a rice with lentils and caramelized onions. You might then have a Turkish dish of braised potatoes with tomatoes and onions, oregano, cayenne, maybe some Turkish sausage in it. And you can, you know, when, by the time you finish, the colours and things look amazing. And it is, it's like a kind of wonderful exotic feast. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly we look to Eastern Europe, and Scandinavia is the thing people have started to look at a bit more as well, partly because they have the same ingredients as we do, and indeed as you do, you know, root vegetables, you know, beets and stuff like that. And I think we also look to Greece, Turkey, and all of these countries. They really have, you know, they have dishes which are very good for you, very healthy, very light, and they're very, very kind to your purse as well.
Okay, I have a challenge because, you know, a lot of us, people get stuck.
I completely agree.
You know, what am I going to do with this?
Yes.
So, okay, I've just handed you a bag full of potatoes.
Okay.
Where are you going to take me with those? Tell me the potatoes.
That's a good thing for an Irish girl to get, to start with a bag of potatoes. That's wonderful. My place to go to for potato dishes would be kind of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. There's a Greek dish, and someone told me about this. They told me they'd had it on holidays, and I thought, it sounds quite plain, but it sounds as if it's got real potential, because she kept saying olive oil rich. It's olive oil rich. So it's potatoes that you saute quite, you stew them, basically sweat them with, and it's the waxy type you need for this, with leeks,
right,
and some onions. And then when they're all kind of softened, you add a bit more olive oil, and you put in, they would use bitter wild leaves, but here we'd use curly endive. I hope you call it the same thing there. It's the lettuce that looks as if it's been stuck into the electric plug.
Yeah.
That and then maybe rockets or watercress or spinach. They would use spinach there and rocket
being,
as well.
Being here, arugula. Yes.
Oh, arugula. Yeah.
Yes.
And you braise that and it needs good seasoning and it also needs quite a good homemade chicken or vegetable stock. But the first time I made this and you got into a rhythm with it, you did the potatoes, then you added more oil and you added the leaves and then you kept turning those over and you serve it. There's some of them are still crisp and some of them are still a little bit bitter, but you want that because that's lovely against that rich oiliness. Lots of dill and lots of mint, and that's incredibly important. We don't, I mean, in this country, and you probably don't there either, cook with the kind of absolute abandonment that they add herbs to dishes with in the Middle East and places like Greece. But you want to be really, you want to be very generous with those and season well. And that is, honestly, a bowl of that. And you can serve it with some yogurt, some Greek yogurt, into which you've chopped a little mint and squeezed some garlic. And that is sumptuous.
That's
and
dinner.
I would, honestly, it sounds like a side dish to most people. That's dinner. Yes.
All right. A brief visit with the potato to Northern Europe.
Oh, my goodness. It would have to be pitipanna, which is kind of the Swedish. It's the Swedish dish they make with leftovers, with a bit of leftover roast on the Monday. I love that.
Well, how is it
done? So it is fried up potatoes. They use raw new potatoes and they'll do that.
Right.
Fry those up in the pan with onion. But I quite often make it with leftovers. And then you want a bit of smoked bacon or smoked sausage and you fry all that around too. They serve this with, on the top of it, they put a raw egg. I put a fried egg on top of it. Serve that with sweet pickled beetroot and some cucumber, a little cucumber salad with a sweet and sour dressing and a glass of lager, very cold golden beer. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is absolutely wonderful. Don't forget the dill as well, because it's got to have that Swedish kind of flavour. But that's, you know, people make it slightly differently, but that's a kind of standard of Swedish home cooking and that's a lovely Northern European way to approach potatoes on a Monday, I think.
Well, Diana, you did it again. Thank you.
I made you hungry.
Yes, very, very hungry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Diana Henry's book is Salt, Sugar, Smoke. You'll find her recipe for Greek potatoes, frisée, spinach, and leeks with dill, mint, and garlic yogurt. Whew, yeah, okay, a lot of ingredients, but not complicated, I promise this. Anyway, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take advantage of all the other possibilities. All free, of course. You can download our podcast, get registered for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, take a look at our online stores, and get registered for our Book of the Month giveaway. It's all there, splendidtable.org. You know that overused expression, good, honest food? Well, it really does apply to what Jane and Michael Stern post on their website, roadfood.com. Hey, you two, welcome back. What's up?
Well, you know the Hank Williams song, Jambalaya, Crawfish Pie, Filet Gumbo?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We have just had some of the best crawfish pie I could ever imagine being made at a place that we have known all along for its meat pies. Now, we're talking about Louisiana country, not New Orleans, but sort of up north in Natchitoches, the funny pronounced name town that actually looks like it should be said Natchitoches, but it's Natchitoches. And in Natchitoches, there's a restaurant called Lazione's.
Which also looks like it should be pronounced Lazy Ones.
Okay, yes. James Lazione opened this restaurant as a meat pie restaurant back in the 1960s. And the meat pies there are sensational. You know, they're kind of folded over, similar to a Cornish pasty. But inside of it is very highly spiced, sort of Cajun-flavored meats. During Lent and on Fridays and at other times of the year when he can get great crawfish, they make a crawfish pie that is just kind of creamy, good, and rich the way a meat pie cannot be.
So this is, okay, so is this big? I mean, I'm thinking of like a calzone half.
It's not calzone size.
Kind of empanada size.
Right.
I would say like a meal would be 2 to 4 of these.
Yes, 2 to 4 of them with a really good side of dirty rice.
Yes.
Which is rice cooked with
giblets of all kinds.
Yeah, gizzards and giblets.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Zesty
yeah.
gravy. You know, when we did the Road Food New Orleans Street Fair, I think Lazione's was everybody's favorite
We did a poll of what was the best food on all of Royal Street during the festival. Number one was the meat pie made by Lazione's. Number two was the crawfish pie made by Lazione's. Because they're so good. Because they were making them right there. I mean, they would fold them over and they would deep fry them. So you'd get it almost too hot to hold. And you bite into it and kind of steam comes up.
Oh,
I mean, it's really a sensational, only in Louisiana favorite.
And you know the new fad of food trucks everywhere and eating on the run. The meat pie in Louisiana really started around the 1800s after the Louisiana Purchase. And Natchitoches was a thriving trade center, and people didn't have time or want to sit down at the table and have long luncheons, so there were little carts set up all over the town serving meat pies or crawfish pies, and they continue to this day.
What is this place like? I mean, is it sort of a roadhouse? Is it a diner?
It's a storefront, but a really wonderful, funky old storefront with a giant papier-mâché meat pie hanging in the window. It's kind of sort of Salvador Dali might have created this display, the way it looks.
Is it melting meat pie?
It's a very comfortable kind of town cafe. It caters mostly to locals because, Natchitoches isn't on everybody's itinerary when they're traveling around Louisiana.
Yeah, but I can just see in my mind's eye these meat pies and these crawfish. Is it crawfish or crayfish?
Well, it's
I always
both,
mix that up.
Mostly in Louisiana, they're saying crawfish.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Do you like crawfish, Lynn?
Do I like crawfish? I love crawfish. I just love crawfish. Yes, I love it.
Ooh-ee. We now know where to eat with you in Louisiana.
Oh, boy. I'm heading out. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye,
Lynn. Take care.
Jambalaya, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio. Big guitar, fill fruit jar, and be gay, oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
Jane and Michael Stern are the proprietors of roadfood.com. Now, we're going to be back with God in a Cup and the new lineup in beers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. For the people who search for the dream cup of coffee, evidently there is a grail, and it's called the God Shot. Michael Weissman uses this as the jumping-off place in her book God in a Cup, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Coffee. Now, this is about coffee's new wave. You know how some people treat wine as a mesmerizing miracle? Well, now coffee is running neck and neck. Michael Weissman joins us from Washington, D.C. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know what's coming.
Yes.
Is the God Shot?
Well, the God Shot is a state of mind, and it is a culinary experience. And I found out about the God Shot because I'm a reporter, not a professional coffee person. And I started reporting on coffee while I was still drinking the real icky stuff. And the story took me to Murky Coffee in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol Hill area, the late lamented Murky Coffee, where Nick Cho, I walked in and he said, do you want a coffee? This is the greatest coffee guy in the East Coast of America at the time. And he said, do you want a coffee? I said, oh, no, I had some this morning. I said, well, I guess I'll have a decaf. And he looked at me.
He picked himself up off the floor.
And said, let me make you something good. And he made me something that took me off my seat and floated me up onto the roof of the building.
What was it?
Well, it was a cappuccino made with this intensely sweet espresso. And I'm drinking this coffee and I've got those wide eyes that, you know, like, oh my God, I've been, you know, where have I been all my life? And I later talked about this experience with actually Peter Giuliano of Counterculture. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, that kind of shot when everything comes together like that, that's called a God shot. And I think this is such a wonderful expression because it captures both the culinary passion of this younger generation of coffee roasters, but also their devotion to coffee and then their sense of coffee as being a larger something, as being almost metaphysical.
Who's driving this? Where is this coming from?
You know, it's driven, as all things seem to be, by technology, by computers, and by the era of cheap travel. And what coming out of the Starbuckian era, a younger generation, now they're all in their 40s, but when they started in their 20s, of coffee guys, many of whom worked as baristas, many of whom never went to college, but they're really smart. They started working in coffee shops and they fell in love with the beverage and they started little roasteries. And because travel was cheap and because you could now communicate with a coffee co-op by computer and later by Skype, they started traveling directly to where the coffee was grown. And this started happening in the early 90s and moved into this century. And this was really the first time that small-scale roasters could have contact with origin, where the coffee is grown. And it changed the nature of the high-end business because coffee was now being pursued not just by a guy in a white suit sitting at the Intercontinental Hotel wheeling and dealing with another colonialist, but by young anti-colonialists who owned their own businesses and who were in love with the beverage, but also had a sense of the farmer as crucial.
You talk in the book about three men who seem to be sort of the driving forces behind this.
Yes, the driving forces, and also they are the essence of this new movement. And one is Peter Giuliano of Counterculture Coffee in Durham, North Carolina. And he started off as a barista and became a roaster and is a kind of natural educator. And then there's Jeff Watts, the extremist of intelligentsia, who's just a very brilliant guy. And he's maybe the most, I mean, a very, very obsessive guy. The guy who say, I will pay anything for great, great coffee. And he and Peter did a lot of original sort of exploring of Africa and Latin America together. And then there's Dwayne Sorensen, who's sort of like the current it boy of coffee. His company, Stumptown, is in Portland and Seattle and now has come to New York, where New York has declared him one step below God. and, you know, and he also is a very talented and very driven coffee guy and quite good at self-promotion.
Are they focusing on a particular kind of coffee? Is there a profile here? Is there a bean that you can point at and say, this could be the great coffee?
What they are all seeking and what they have given all of us as consumers is they understand that coffee is a beverage that is grown around the entire globe on a band around the equator, and that each origin, each specific area is capable, when the conditions are right and the altitude is right and the weather is right, of producing magnificent coffee. And they understand that this is not a standardized product. The great coffee that I'm drinking today won't be available in 6 weeks because it's a seasonal product, and my wonderful roaster roasts it all up, and then it's gone, and then I have to wait till next year.
There's one coffee, though. Is the Esmeralda?
Yes, Esmeralda. Now, Esmeralda is a really fascinating coffee that sort of took the coffee world by storm. It first appeared on cupping tables in 2004 in Panama, and people kind of went crazy, and they didn't know what they were tasting. And over the course of the year, the price of this coffee has been bid up. 2 years ago, I think it was $130 a pound, the top lots went for. I mean, it's just insane, but it's because it doesn't taste like anything you've ever tasted. And it turns out that this is an Ethiopian coffee that, through complicated methods I won't describe, wound up being planted by maybe one of the most talented farmers in all of the coffee-growing world. And when this coffee was first cupped by professionals, one very well-known coffee guy tasted this very, it's a very delicate, floral, almost tea-like coffee. And he said, although I am not a religious man, I think I have seen the face of God in this cup.
Wow.
And again, we're back to the God shot.
But I'm the lowly consumer. Is there anywhere I can taste Esmeralda?
Yes, but not this time of year. The people who are growing the Esmeralda, the Petersons, have gone the way of the finest winemakers, and they now auction off a series of lots of Esmeralda from their farm. And all three of the high-end roasters I just described, as well as a terroir in Boston and several others, mm-hmm. Buy up lots of this in the spring. And in New York, in cafes during the summer, you could get a cup of Esmeralda for maybe $6. You could order it online. The prices vary because, as with wine, the terroir is important and the lot prices vary. But you could probably buy a half pound of Esmeralda for maybe $25, which will give you a half pound, will give you 20 cups of coffee.
Huh.
So it's not, I always talk about coffee as an affordable luxury, even at the highest end.
So if we're patient and we wait for the season, we can experience God in a cup.
Absolutely, Lynn.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been a pleasure.
Michael Weissman is author of God in a Cup, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Coffee. Now you can find Michael's chapter on how to make a great cup of coffee at home. And you can try a recipe made with coffee from Bruce Idell's. It's called Spare Ribs with Coffee Molasses Marinade. And all of this, believe it or not, is you know where. The website, splendidtable.org. In the beginning, there was beer. The all-American, almost everyone the same beer. Then came the microbrews, or craft beers, all different, and as prolific as Starbucks. So now is the next big moment, the snifter beer? Well, to answer that, Andy Crouch joins us. Craft beer is his beat. He's written Great American Craft Beers, A Guide to the Nation's Finest Beers and Breweries. Andy, welcome.
Good to be here, Lynn.
So, okay. I've noticed that there are these unbelievably high alcohol beers, like 40%. I mean, is this the next big deal in beer?
In the last 5 years or so, we've really seen this sort of explosion of flavor in something in the beer world that's been called extreme brewing. And that has really pushed the envelope in helping to define, you know, what the parameters of beer are. You know, we once thought of beer as sort of this yellow, cold, fizzy substance, and now we have beers that, you know, taste, smell, and act exactly like fine cognac. So it is definitely a very interesting trend, and one that, you know, we're starting to see quite a few breweries from around the world trying to take part in sort of this alcohol arms race.
Why are they going after this? I mean, it just seems to be such an odd direction for beer to take, because it always seemed to me that the finesse in beer was bringing out flavor or bringing out a particular character of an ingredient, not just going for that high alcohol.
And I think that's definitely true, and balance remains important. But I think for a number of brewers, they have really developed a lot of flavors with hops, with barley malt, and with yeast. And this is just the next frontier for them in terms of checking out flavor. So this isn't just for these brewers about just trying to build something akin to grain alcohol. I think they're going more in the area of trying to be single malt scotch. They, you know, say there can be a lot of alcohol there, but we can really make, you know, fine, high-quality beverages that really begin to test the limits of what beer can be and to try new flavors.
Can you age these beers?
they can be aged. And this is something I encourage people in my book to try at home, because beer is such a reasonably priced beverage that, you know, some beers, when you age them, especially ones that have, you know, higher alcohol above 8 or 10%, can take on different flavors as the beers get a little, you know, a year or two of age. The hops drop out a little bit. It gets a little less bitter. And really, when hops drop out, what you have left behind are these really rich caramel kind of toasted flavors that can develop into a whole range of different things. You can see them going more towards toffee and sweetness, and a little bit more towards fruit. And then alcohol itself does add character to beer. You get, you know, some of that warming quality that, you know, people enjoy in their after dinner drinks.
So is there a flip side to this in terms of what's happening that's new in beer?
There is, and there are a number of brewers who sort of look at this alcohol arms race and say, that's not for me. We want to go in the opposite direction. And that's what has traditionally been called session beer. And that's talking about beers that are, generally speaking, under 5% alcohol in the United States, preferably even under 4% alcohol. And they're beers that, you know, still mine fantastic flavors, but do it in a way that, you know, you can have a conversation with your friends over a couple of hours and a couple of pints and not be a real mess at the end of it all.
What's the average alcohol content of most of the beers we drink?
Most beers are about 5 to 5.5% alcohol. So when you knock off a couple of ounces, you know, people don't think that that makes a big difference. But really, you know, over the course of, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 pints, you know, over a few hours with friends, it makes a big deal.
So what about the taste of these sessions beers?
Oh, they can be fantastic. I think that sometimes people consider sort of lower alcohol beers to be inferior in terms of quality or flavor, and that's just not the case. It takes, you know, real craft, real artisan brewers to be able to bring out flavor without having to rely upon sort of the crutch of alcohol. So you can have, you know, session beers can be almost any style. They can be deep, roasted, you know, chocolatey stouts, or they can be really bright, lively, fruity ales. I would suggest, you know, there's a brewery in San Diego, California, the Stone Brewing Company, that's known for these, you know, higher alcohol, big, strong, assertive beers. But they make this, you know, sort of lighter, flavorful beer called Levitation. It's about 4.5% alcohol. Still very hoppy.
What a lovely name.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff.
Is it tougher to make low alcohol beers?
I think that there are challenges definitely on both sides of the equation. But when it comes to low alcohol beers, I think people just normally think, well, I'm not interested in that. It probably doesn't have a lot of flavor. But being able to, you know, rely upon the ingredients themselves to bring out the character of the beer, I think it's a real challenge. And not a lot of brewers do it as well as, you know, as people who love session beer would hope they would.
Interesting. I can actually step up to the bar and say, I'll have a session beer, thank you very much.
Yes, and I think that that's starting to be more of a thing. People are wanting to see alcohol levels on menus and to know what they're getting into. Because, as you said, you know, with beer expanding its parameters, who knows sometimes if you're ordering an 8 or 9 or 10% triple or something like that.
Yeah. Andy, thanks for talking with us.
Certainly, Lynn. It was great to be here.
Andy Crouch is author of Great American Craft Beer. For his picks of snifter beers and session beers, and my chicken recipe called Brabant Braise with prunes and Gers beer, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Call me if you're feeling lonely, call me. If you're feeling blue, if you don't believe me, call and say you need me. And darling, I will come to you. Call me. It is time to turn to your calls. Anything goes. Call us, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. And you can find us on Facebook. Okay, let's see. We've got Mark calling from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Hey, Mark, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's about roasting Thanksgiving turkey. I've been roasting a turkey in an electric wall oven, and I roast it uncovered, and it's in an herb. I rub it with an herb mixture, right. And I cover the breast with a cheesecloth moistened with butter and wine, and baste it periodically with whatever's left from the original mixture.
Right.
And it seems that at the end of the process, there's not a lot of pan drippings.
Hmm.
And I seem to remember more pan drippings when I had a gas oven. And I was wondering if it's the electric oven. Is it too dry in there?
You know, there may be a slight difference, but it's really not a huge difference.
Mm.
What depth is the pan you're using now, and is it different from the pan you used to use?
Not a whole lot. I don't think it's any different, really.
Is it any difference in size? Because, you know, the more heat that surrounds the turkey, so in so many words, the more shallow the pan.
Right.
Right. The more that you're going to get real roasting, which is the exterior starts to crisp.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really hold in the juices, but it kind of does.
Right.
Well, how's that for a really definitive answer?
Yeah.
It doesn't, but it does. Yeah, right.
The turkeys come out really moist, you know, so that's one thing. So I guess, you know,
you're doing it right.
Yeah.
You know what would be fun to do? Because this is what, whenever in doubt, I baste with wine.
I was thinking of just
because
doing that.
Yeah. In the beginning, baste with a bit of wine, like a half a bottle, depending on
right.
the size of the turkey. And I don't mean pour it in all at once, but add, you know, a half a cup after 20 minutes and another,
right.
you know, 30, 40 minutes, add a little more. And keep basting with those pan juices. That wine will, just about all the alcohol is going to cook off, and that wine is going to create just an incredible pan sauce.
Right.
So I think you'd be home free with that.
All right.
Yeah. And you know what? If that pan sauce is really rich tasting, that can start a pan gravy that's stunning. And if you make a turkey broth with it, you're home free and you've
right.
got a great
gravy. Right. Actually, I've made the stock already. So, you know.
I love people who are prepared.
Well.
Mark,
big
this
plans.
This is going to be the turkey to end all turkeys.
Well,
I guarantee it.
Great.
Go forth and roast. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Now, we're going to be back with more of your questions in a minute. But first, I've got this week's trivia challenge. Here's the question. What started out purple, came from gun ammunition, and is found in just about every kitchen in America? Now, you mull that for a while. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a minute, so get in touch. But before we do, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what started out purple, came from gun ammunition, and is found in just about every kitchen in America? Well, the answer is iodized salt. And the iodine is the story. You see, in 1811, when Napoleon was warring his way through Europe, a French maker of potassium nitrate, which is a key ingredient in ammunition, had a problem. He made his potassium nitrate by burning seaweed. And there was an accident that happened while cleaning the vats that are used to burn the seaweed. It left behind purple-colored crystals. Now, these were a new element, which he named iodine, after the Greek for violet. Scientists got their hands on iodine and discovered that it stopped goiters, so it was added to table salt. And that is what is in that ubiquitous blue box. Essentially, a munitions mistake. Okay, back to your calls, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter, check us out on Facebook, send us an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Elizabeth on the line from Brussels. Elizabeth, is that as in Belgium?
That is as in Belgium.
I lived there for a period of time. It's good to hear a voice from Brussels. What do you want to talk about?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to ask my questions. And time is of the essence because they are about Christmas fruitcakes. I've made 3 cakes in the last week, each one with different spices, different dried fruit, and different alcohols.
Right.
And the one I made with the tropical fruits, I used dried mango, papaya, pineapple, coconut, and banana.
Oh, that sounds great.
And I steamed them in overproof rum, which was the alcohol I used to pour over that cake.
Right.
And yet, when I tasted the cake after, there was no discernible tropical flavor at all. And I was wondering if I had reconstituted them in the wrong thing, or if maybe over time those flavors will come out. But I was pretty disappointed just to get sort of a bland cake flavor.
Gee, that's curious. You know, this may come down to the quality of the dried fruits because, you know, some dried fruits are very intense and some aren't. But
okay.
You soak them in a high-proof rum.
Well, I heated them over the stove so that they would absorb the rum, yes.
Yeah, I see. I'm just wondering if maybe that would have overpowered them.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Was there a large amount of the fruits in proportion to the cake batter?
Not particularly. And in addition to those fruits, I did use raisins and the typical dried citron and orange as well.
That may be the problem. That may be the problem. Yeah. I think what you want to do, if you want to go for that tropical fruit flavor, okay, first of all, if you possibly can, taste the fruit before you buy it. It should be really intense. And then I would say load up the cake with that fruit. And since you're not going to be using candied fruits, you may want to add a little more sugar to the basic batter. But that's what I would do. I think you just need to pile them on because, you know, compared to those candied fruits that are very forward in flavor, right?
Right.
Right.
Well, then if I could also ask you about the different alcohols that one could use, I tried in each of the cakes one Calvados, one cognac, and one overproof rum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, what do you normally use? Does it make a big difference? Do you have to watch the alcohol content? And finally, would you ever go into a more syrupy liqueur like a Grand Marnier or an Amaretto?
I don't think I'd go that route because I think that'll overpower. But I've used cognac, I've used all three over the years. Yeah,
right.
It's been a while. But here's my thought. I don't think the liquor gives you a particularly distinctive flavor. But now that said, if you were to take that Calvados and let apples sit in it for a period of time and then have it, you know, just stick some apples in the bottle, don't let the alcohol escape, then use it, you'd get some of that flavor. And with the rum, if you put some of those dried fruits like dried pineapple in it or dried mango, then it would have some flavor. One of the other things I've done is I've actually made a rum syrup with vanilla and a little sugar and a lot of the rum. And I've cooked off some of the alcohol in the process, but boy, does it make the cake taste good. So,
and you feed the cake with that as you would at regular intervals.
Yeah, exactly. And that gives it a nice little kind of punch to it. I would say try sweetening that rum and giving it a little vanilla and make the cake with all of those dried tropical fruits.
Right.
I think you're going to like it.
All right. Thanks so much.
You are welcome. And say
hello.
I'll
let you know how it turns out.
Please do. And say hello to Brussels for me.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us 800-537-5252. Isn't it good to know somebody's still making fruitcakes? I like this. Anyway, we now have Victoria calling from Nantucket. Victoria, what do you want to talk about?
My question is about free-range chickens. We have been raising them in my backyard, and I know some people across the street who do the same thing. So we tend to wake up early in the morning with roosters, but that's
right,
okay.
Right.
And they're truly free range. They run around the yard. They eat the bugs. They eat the grass. They eat fresh, you know, vegetable cuttings, very little grain. And we have slaughtered some and cooked them. And I baked the first one in just the normal way I would do a grocery store chicken at 350 degrees with, you know, basting it with its own juices,
right,
salt and pepper,
right,
and olive oil. And it was a little dry and very, very lean, no fat whatsoever, and a little chewy. And so the next one I added more moisture and again cooked it at 350 and basted it more often. And again, it was dry and a little bit tough. There's very little breast meat on these things.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to know is, do you have any ideas about how to make a chicken, you know, moist and tender without overpowering its own natural flavor?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'm just thinking how delicious they must be.
Oh, they are. They're just wonderful.
Because, you know, you're talking about when people talk about the old-time chicken, that's what it is.
It's what it is, yeah.
Yeah, they're out there free-ranging like crazy.
Oh, they're running around all over the place. They chase the dog chases them. You know, their legs are nice and strong.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, this is the thing. The slower you cook most proteins,
mm-hmm.
the more natural moisture remains within the muscle of the meat. So if you were to cook these at, let's say, start them at 325 and then knock the heat down to 275 or 300
mm-hmm.
and cook them slow, okay,
mm-hmm.
I think that would help things. And the other thing is, obviously, braising these things, cooking them with a little bit of liquid is going to just help them along. But you want to keep the temperature very modest. You want to cook them really slowly. Now, one other thing comes to mind, but this does change flavor a bit, and that's brining them.
Salting them.
Yeah, and the idea being here that you would make a brine, it's usually a quarter of a cup of salt, something flaky like kosher salt or mm-hmm. sea salt. You're on Nantucket.
Yeah.
Hey, does anybody make salt on Nantucket, by the way?
Don't you? It seems like the most natural thing in the world, but we are so humid that the salt would never dry naturally. So you'd have to use some kind of, it'd have to be some kind of factory. I mean, I know some countries, they just bring the salt water up and let it dry out in the sun, but.
Okay, so you're not going to use Nantucket salt, but anyway, it could be a coarse sea salt of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure about a quarter of a cup per quart of very cold water, and you can add a little bit of sugar to that because that seems to soften the impact of the salt. You don't taste sweetness. You just mm-hmm. get, if you add like 3 tablespoons of sugar, brown sugar, you get just a mellowness to it. And then you can add seasonings too. You could add herbs to that
mm-hmm.
or you could add wine. But here's the point that if you let, for every pound of chicken, if you let it sit in that in the refrigerator for about an hour, don't go too far.
Mm-hmm.
That will literally plump out the cells that hold moisture in the meat.
Hmm.
Now, it's going to season it, obviously.
And right. If I wanted to add salt and pepper anyway.
Well, that's true. That's true. And using about a quarter of a cup of salt, not the regular salt like the iodized salt, because mm-hmm. then you'd want less. You'd want maybe 3 tablespoons. But an iodized salt doesn't have a good flavor. But that's all beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you were to try that, you would get it plumped up a bit. And then I'd still cook it slow.
Okay.
And if you want to brown the skin at the last, you know, toward the last, flip on the broiler or turn the oven up to blast.
Right.
And
right.
let it go. But it just sounds like you've got these great chickens. And,
oh, we do. And they're delicious. But yeah, they're chewy.
Using this, you may end up with something that's a little juicier.
That would be great. Flynn, thanks so much.
Hey, you have a great one.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. You know, getting off the express roads and traveling small-town America can make for some very interesting finds. It's not only the scenery and the food. When you take time to stop and linger, it's the people who mark the place. As David Valdez Greenwood has discovered, David is the author of The Rhinestone Sisterhood, A Journey Through Small-Town America, One Tiara at a Time. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
David, the Rhinestone Sisterhood, beauty queens. What's the motivation?
Well, actually, the motivation is that they were not beauty queens. They're festival queens, which is a little different. They're these small town girls who represent often the food or industry of their town that their town is famous for, and they spend a year really doing community service for their town. And I loved the girls putting themselves out there and being the face of this town and doing good things.
So this isn't a beauty contest. It's really about what, citizenship?
Very much. It's really a civic duty-focused world that the girls are in. They do have pageants, but most of the points come off stage when they are wowing the judges with their knowledge of the Louisiana swine industry or the 20 kinds of cattle that you know are sold and distributed in Louisiana, or why a particular food means something to their town.
Why did you focus on Louisiana?
Well, you know, I didn't start out that way. I was going to go around the country. It's a tradition that actually spreads out to most states, and there are over 1,000 festivals that crown queens around the U.S.
Right.
And so I started in Ohio, and I went to Washington, and then I landed in Louisiana, and I landed in Rain, Louisiana, the home of the Frog Festival, and I was just immediately drawn to the local culture and embraced by the local culture, and I wanted to set down roots and follow one group of queens. And in Louisiana, the tradition is so thorough and so deep. The queens from all over the state are traveling around the state weekend after weekend, and they become this sisterhood. And I thought, if I follow around Louisiana for a year, I'll really, really see their roles in the communities and their relations with each other.
So you started out, there's actually a town, well, Rain is the
Rain.
Name of the town. Yeah. Am I right? Because I think that's the Latin version or related to frog.
I don't actually know if that's true. I know that the town's connection to frogs is that in the 1880s, there was a local chef selling their bullfrogs to New Orleans restaurants. And these French brothers, Jacques Weil and his brother, sampled those there and said, hey, this could be an industry. And from there, they started selling the frogs from this little town in Louisiana in New York City. Sardis put on the menu, frog legs from Rain, Louisiana, frog capital of the world.
Huh.
And the town ran with it. And so their frog legs were sold in Paris. Pretty much if you ate frog legs in a fancy restaurant anywhere in the world for 80 years, they came from this small town.
That's pretty amazing. So they have a frog queen.
And they actually have a dozen or so frog queens of all ages, from down to the little tadpole queens up through the golden frogs, which are a king and queen that are seniors. But their frog queen, the Miss Queen, really works hard for the town. For a year, she gives up a good 40 to 45 of her weekends traveling to other festivals, representing the town.
This is hardworking stuff.
Absolutely.
I'm picturing all these queens with their tiaras just lined up, feasting together. Does that ever happen?
Oh, yeah. The queens, for their field duties, during the daytimes, the queens are not dressed up. They're usually in T-shirts and jeans and mud boots, because if they go to a festival, they'll be asked to, you know, chase a greased pig or be out picking vegetables. But they always keep their crown and banner on. So if you, for instance, I mentioned the swine festival, they have a boudin eating contest, and you have 30 girls in their crowns stuffing their face with, you know, pork intestine, liver, and heart as fast as they can. If you go to the Orange Festival, they have to fill their mouths with kumquats. You know, they're going to these festivals, and they're trying to show their appreciation for being hosted. So they're lining up in beautiful silk gowns and banners and all of their regalia with big plates of gumbo on their lap and chatting away while they eat.
You know, the kind of thing you just don't hear about.
You know, that's kind of an amazing thing, is that I really did not know much about this world, and I would say your average American doesn't, and yet all over the country there are versions of these festival queens. And it's such a neat, positive part of the culture. We have so much in our time that is cynical and sarcastic and the easy laugh, and instead we have this real zest for life and joy in this great tradition.
David, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
David Valdez Greenwood is the author of The Rhinestone Sisterhood. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Jay Leno, who said, "Isn't it a little ironic here? We pick politicians by how they look on TV, and Miss America on where she stands on issues. Isn't that a little bit backward?" The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. You're going to find it all, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.